welcome to ASME TechCast, bringing you the innovators, the innovations, and the issues that push the envelope of engineering. I'm Jeffrey Winters, Editor-in-Chief at Mechanical Engineering Magazine. And today, we are talking about the future of automobiles with our guest, Kelly Senecal. Dr. Senecal is co-founder and owner of Convergent Science, a computational fluid dynamics software company in Madison, Wisconsin, and an adjunct professor in the University of Wisconsin School of Engineering. He's also a member of the executive committee of ASME's Internal Combustion Engine Division. Dr. Senecal, welcome to the big show.
Jeff, thanks for having me.
And something that I think almost all of our listeners are really going to have a stake in, because it's about the future of automobiles. Over the past few years, there's been a push towards overhauling the way cars and trucks are powered. In countries throughout Europe and Asia, and now in the United States, there are mandates for increasing the share of electric vehicle sales. And in some places, the mandates essentially ban sales of conventional petroleum-powered cars and trucks sometime over the next decade. Those measures are being taken to help reduce carbon dioxide emissions in the transportation sector. Dr. Senecal recently wrote a book, Racing Toward Zero, with Felix Lynch, about automotive propulsion systems and especially how which ones provide the best path towards sustainable, low carbon emission transport. And Dr. Senecal and Dr. Leach find that contrary to the relentless push toward electric vehicles, the best way to provide clean, cheap, sustainable automobility may not be EVs, or at least not only EVs. Instead of electric vehicles, the future may belong to, as Dr. Senecal likes to put it, eclectic vehicles, depending on where you are and perhaps more importantly, why you are driving. It's a deep subject, and I admit we'll only be able to scratch the surface, but let's dig in. Dr. Senecal, let's begin with some basic. People look at the state of automobile technology as a given. You know, most of us have cars that burn petroleum and spark ignition internal combustion engines. And then there's the stuff that falls outside the category. But your book starts off with a pretty complete overview of the history and present state of vehicle technology. And up until about 100 years ago, there was some competition to the internal combustion engine. Why did the ICE become so dominant?
Yeah, that's a great question. Now, as you know, horse-drawn carriages were actually still the dominant mode of transportation at the beginning of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. But the problems with horse-drawn carriages, I mean, horses were susceptible to disease, and their manure was a huge source of pollution. And many people don't realize, and it's kind of weird to think about this now, that the reason we switched from horses to self-propelled cars, or at least a big reason, was to get rid of the pollution, right? That's a bit ironic given where we are today. But in addition to horses, we essentially had three technologies that competed at that time, right? We had steam engines, gasoline vehicles, and electric cars. Now, steam-powered cars were kind of the tried and tested technology, but they had very practical limits. They had long startup times, in order to generate enough steam. They had a limited range, they had frequent maintenance. And so by about 1920, steam cars had essentially disappeared. And now we're down to our competition between gasoline and electric vehicles, much like we are today. So I like to tell people, you know, it's a big misconception that internal combustion engines are old technology and electric cars are new technology, right? They've been duking it out for well over 100 years. So electric cars actually had a lot of advantages over gasoline cars at the time. So gas cars were loud and dirty and had to be started using a hand crank. And you actually needed to have a lot of strength, and it actually could be dangerous to use that hand crank. But electric cars didn't have these problems. They were easy to operate, they were quiet, and they didn't have a tailpipe, right? But they did suffer from the same thing that we talk about today. They suffered from limited range. And at the start of the 20th century, range wasn't much of an issue because roads between cities were very rough. So it was hard to drive on these roads with any type of vehicle. Most of the driving was in urban areas. But as these roads between cities started to improve and people actually wanted to travel from city to city, that kind of came on, and the same challenges for electric cars that we see today started limiting their use. Again, the low range could no longer really cut it as rural driving became more prominent. There's also a lack of charging infrastructure. And just like they are today, EVs are expensive, or were expensive. But the biggest kind of blow to the electric car, I think, or one of the biggest blows, and really what cemented the internal combustion engine dominance, was when Henry Ford released the gasoline-powered Model T in 1908. So this, unlike the EVs, this was a car that was affordable for middle-class Americans. And then a little bit later, Charles Kettering invented what's called the electric starter. So he removed the need to use that kind of hand crank that could be dangerous and hard to use. That became obsolete, and ICE cars were now very easy to start. Finally, as you know, we discovered crude oil in Texas. Fuel became very cheap. And by about 1930, 1935, the internal combustion engine ruled the roads.
So, but initially, I mean, it sounds like one of the implementing steps was actually infrastructural, getting the roads and sort of the gas stations and all the infrastructure needed to take advantage of the greater potential range of internal combustion engine cars. So, I mean, kind of like today where people talk about EVs needing a lot of infrastructure to make them practical, there was also a need for infrastructure for conventional automobiles at that time.
Oh, totally. I mean, yeah, we started from nothing, right? So, but cars, the internal combustion engine cars were cheap enough, the fuel was cheap enough, and they had that range. So it was worth doing, at least at the time we felt it was worth doing. Where clearly we didn't do that for electric vehicles. Those sort of died out in about the 1930s. Of course, they're back today, which we'll talk more about in this conversation. But yeah, you're absolutely right.
Now, I mean, let's jump ahead just a little bit to the 1970s. I don't remember the 1920s, but I do remember the 1970s. And oil availability and air pollution made a lot of folks reconsider whether internal combustion engines were the best way to power vehicles. But it's only been recently, maybe even in the last 10 years, 15 years, really, that anything's been able to challenge the internal combustion engine in the marketplace. Was it just because batteries got cheap enough, or was there some other technological or even social changes that made that change possible?
Yeah, that's a great question, and something we highlight in the book quite a bit. We like to talk about the different rise and falls of electric cars, and so we talked about in the last question you asked, the early electric cars from over 100 years ago. Now, obviously, those were around for a while, but they kind of dropped off for the reasons we just talked about. But we also had in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, and again, 70s, the blip there did come mainly from the high gasoline prices, as we talked about. We had these experimental BEVs that were being tested, and they were, you saw some of them on the roads. They never really reached that, high numbers. They, again, suffered from limited performance and range. Okay, then we had in the 1990s, I don't know if you've ever seen a GM EV1. They're kind of interesting to look at. There's a documentary, I don't know if you've seen Who Killed the Electric Car, but I'd watched it back kind of when it first came out, and then I watched it again while writing the book, basically, to help do some research. And what was really interesting, and it kind of relates to your question about the batteries, that documentary blamed just about everyone and everything besides the battery technology itself. But in reality, I mean, I would say, given what I know, the battery technology was not yet ready. So now we're leading up to what you're talking about, right? So we had the destruction of the EV1 program. That really motivated the founding of Tesla Motors. And we know that now as Tesla Incorporated. And they really showed that an electric car can be exciting. And that really wasn't done, I would say, at least from my opinion, any of the electric cars up until that point. It was exciting. It was, had high torque. And of course, Tesla's market cap blew up, right? So all the companies wanted to be like Tesla. So while each of the previous rises of electric cars had associated falls, I don't think there's really any fall in sight, at least not in the foreseeable future this time. So now really to your question, so what's different this time? Why the rise this time without the fall? I think one of the biggest factors might be Dieselgate, right? Dieselgate kind of broke in 2015. And, for EVs to do well, it doesn't hurt for them to have their competition, take a blow, right? And so Dieselgate, which I think the listeners know, that was when car manufacturer was kind of cheating on their emissions, specifically NOx emissions. And that really left a stain not only on diesel engines, but also the internal combustion engine in general. And after Dieselgate, after 2015, within the next couple of years, we really started seeing a lot of media demonization of the IC engine. Now, if you add to that, add to Tesla and Dieselgate, sort of a renewed focus on climate, you know, ever tightening fuel economy and CO2 regulations. Something I like to talk about is BEVs, battery electric vehicles, count as zero CO2 because we only consider the tailpipe. Sometimes they count as more than one zero CO2 car just to kind of, you know, again, motivate their sales. What they allow car companies to do is sell larger gasoline trucks and SUVs while still meeting their fleet average targets because they can claim zero CO2 for the BEVs. So that's something that is kind of attractive to auto companies, right? And then the threat of bans, as you talked about, large EV subsidies, and really a much better consumer experience. It still takes a long time to charge, but it's significantly faster than it was, longer range, improved infrastructure. And the time really is ripe now for this competition that we saw in the early 1900s to kind of come back among the various technologies. But again, the battery tech is a big part of it, like you talked about. It is much better and cheaper, right? These old electric cars use lead acid batteries. But then we've had consumer electronics which have really pushed the lithium ion battery technology, right? And that's what we use today, primarily in electric vehicles. They have a much higher energy density than lead acid batteries, you know, which makes them smaller and lighter and more practical to use on cars. And then of course there is the cost, right? In 2010, so 12 years ago, the cost per kilowatt hour for an EV battery pack, I think was over $1,000 at that time. And now it's getting down near the $100 per kilowatt hour mark. So cost is definitely a big part of it, but really all of those things, right? It's this perfect storm, all these things coming together and really kind of making the EV kind of a compelling competition for the internal combustion engine. And that's where we are today.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of interesting that it was really the consumer electronics space and actually the cell phone and portable, you know, laptop computer space that really drove the lithium ion battery technology. And then that's being able to be adapted for automobiles.
Yeah, definitely. That was a big part of it. And I think, I mean, today, if we were still using lead acid batteries, I don't think we'd be having this conversation. So the advancements in batteries, in particular lithium ion, you know, there's a lot of work going on in solid state batteries and other sort of battery chemistries. And maybe we'll see another sort of kind of revolution in the batteries. But for now, lithium ion is still sort of the dominant one. And a lot of it does, you know, they really do have to thank the consumer electronics industry for that.
Now, as we've mentioned here, today there's a push both from governments and from the automakers themselves in some cases to promote, you know, electric vehicles and also to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And you know, some of the countries have enacted bans on the sales of standard IC powered cars. But in your book, you put forth the case that this may not actually be the best approach if the ultimate goal is cutting carbon emissions. Walk us through your argument. I mean, as someone, you know, who walks down the street in Brooklyn and sees people snaking, you know, extension cords out to their Teslas, I mean, it seems like people really want, you know, are buying into the EVs as the future. So why is this perhaps misguided?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. And, you know, I just want to say up front here, just the audience kind of recognizes that I do certainly believe electric cars are part of the solution for cutting carbon from transportation. As you noted, Jeff, earlier, I just don't think they're the entire solution. They're not the whole solution. And in fact, if we want to reduce greenhouse gases from driving as quickly as we can, we need a mixture of solutions. And this has exactly, I mean, your example there in Brooklyn kind of leads into this very nicely, because the world is a diverse place. There are many places in the world where they don't even have access to electricity, right? Let alone that they're in an apartment and they have to run an extension cable, you know, out their window. Mm-hmm. A solution that works in Norway, for example, which has a very clean electric grid due to their hydroelectric power, it's not necessarily the best solution where I live in Wisconsin. In fact, it isn't. We have some recent work that's about to be published. It was accepted for publication a few weeks ago, where we do sort of a life cycle analysis comparing these different technologies, because let's be honest, it's about a lot more than just the tailpipe. Even though the regulations focus on the tailpipe, it really has to do with the car production, battery production. It can be very CO2 intense. you know, where does the electricity come from, and so on and so forth. And so driving, for example, driving a full hybrid vehicle, so not a plug-in hybrid necessarily, mm-hmm. but a full hybrid in Wisconsin can lead to less CO2 per mile driven than a battery electric vehicle. Other states in the US, it's a different story. It just depends on where you live. And again, this is partly because of the very different electricity grids around the world. And again, even from state to state in the US. Now, you'll always hear that, well, we're gonna move to a fully renewable grid in 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. But what's interesting is even as we move closer and closer to an all renewable grid, which I think is, you know, I hope we get there someday, mm-hmm. Fossil fuels still make up a large portion of the actual electricity used to charge your EV, even if you have a fairly high percentage renewable grid. And this is something that there's a lot of debate in the community of average electricity mix versus marginal electricity mix, but really fossil fuels can easily respond to additional demand on the grid, whether it's your toaster or an electric vehicle. So we have to be careful about how we're counting the electricity that we use to charge our electric vehicle. And because of that, hybrids are often better from a CO2 perspective, not always, but they often are. And again, it depends on where you are and what your application is. But the other thing that we have to remember is just as the grid is becoming more and more renewable over time, our fuels are actually cleaning up as well. So the fuel that we put into the engine. So I like to say it's not the engine that's the problem. It's the fuel. It's the fossil fuels. So we can use more and more renewable fuels. This is a very challenging area. There's still a lot of work to be done. They're still pretty costly in a lot of cases. In some cases, not so costly. You have things like biofuels and things like that. But these drop-in ready fuels allow us to maintain the same infrastructure and consumer habits, right? And that's a big benefit. It also lets us decarbonize the existing fleet, right? So, you know, people can start buying electric vehicles starting today, every new vehicle purchased. But what about all the cars that are still going to be on the road for many, many years, right? So if we can somehow work to decarbonize those as well with better fuels, then that's really important.
So let me just unpack that a little bit.
Yeah.
From what it sounds like you're saying, it's not really whether the power is coming, you know, through the power that's coming to the transmission to the wheels. It's what's important is where the fuel starts off. It's the whole weld the wheels thing.
So
if you've got an electric vehicle and you're in West Virginia, it's not an electric vehicle. It's essentially a coal powered vehicle.
And so
the more the, you know, so when you look at the fuel, if you have a cleaner fuel, if you know, I think petroleum is cleaner than coal, so obviously if you're running it off of coal and it's just or running it off of petroleum and it's you have an efficient engine, you're going to be better off for the, you know, carbon emission front than if you have a coal powered vehicle, I would imagine. And you're saying that as we clean up the fuel end, if we, you know, put more biofuels in, maybe come up with a way of you know, sort of a electro fuel, you know, made from
yes.
renewable hydrogen, something like that. That would mm-hmm. actually be a better way to reduce net emissions than a purely electric vehicle, depending on what's on the grid.
Yeah, it definitely could be. I mean, like I said, e-fuels, you know, creating e-fuels today is still fairly challenging, although there's a lot of research in this area. It's still pretty expensive. But that doesn't mean, I mean, look at where we were, you know, 20 years ago with batteries, right? Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have thought that we would be where we are today. And so why wouldn't we assume that we could make a breakthrough in something like electrofuels or e-fuels? And so I think that this is my big thing is, and we talked about banning sort of in the start of this question. I'm really against banning any technology. You know, what I like is the government to set goals and say, okay, engineers, auto companies, whoever, these are the goals we have to achieve. Use mm-hmm. whatever technology you can use that makes sense to get us there. And the downside, because if we don't do that, what could happen is we could go down this electric vehicle route, go all in on electric vehicles, which I think a lot of the world is starting to do at this point. And we could, you know, 30 years from now, we could realize, oh, there are all these unintended consequences we weren't thinking of. And we already know mm-hmm. what some of them might be, but there's always unintended consequences when you put all your eggs in one basket. This is why we are where we are today, because we put all our eggs in the internal combustion engine fueled by fossil fuel basket, right? And why wouldn't we learn from history and kind of keep the diverse kind of portfolio of solutions out there? Because otherwise we could end up in 30 years and say, wow, we really need ICE, we really need internal combustion engines, but now we're dealing with 30-year-old technology, which it could have been so much cleaner if we would have kept up the, you know, kept up the work to improve it. So, you know, whenever you start even talking about bans, let alone actually doing them, you risk funding, you risk students not wanting to go into those areas because they're worried. And there's a lot of risk there. So I think, you know, I'm not a big fan of bans, as you can probably guess, at all. So
another point that you make in your book is that I want to talk about this because it pushes a little bit on the idea that, well, you need to set efficiency goals rather than banning or mandating certain technologies. Mm-hmm. You know, there's, you know, consumer choice can often confound efficiency improvements. I mean, you include some charts that show that over the past three decades, the median weight of vehicles sold in the U.S. has gone up by more than 500 pounds, and the power of the engine has gone up by 75%. A lot of that's being driven by consumers buying SUVs and pickups rather than sedans, you know, but, you know, all of the efficiency improvements and that have gone into the internal combustion engine over the last three decades, and they've been considerable, have really been eaten up because of the shifting consumer choice. I mean, if the goal is improving efficiency, how do we control for that?
Yeah, that's a very complicated question, but I do think about this question quite a bit. And I'm not going to pretend I have all the answers, but let me kind of give you my take on it.
Okay.
And you're right. You know, we, especially Americans, we love our trucks and SUVs. And now what's even crazier, in my opinion, we have electric versions of the largest vehicles out there, right? And the reason why I think that's crazy, by the way, driving a very large and heavy truck isn't really green, no matter what's powering. I mean, at the end of the day, driving a big, massive electric vehicle truck is not green. But the problem here is with electric versions, there's this false sense of guilt-free driving, right? Because we're told day in and day out in the media, even in our regulations, that these are zero emission vehicles. We even call them that in the regulations. So it kind of gives the consumer this free pass to drive around this really, you know, heavy vehicle, this large heavy vehicle. But again, when you think about how are you charging it, how is that enormous battery being produced and all the CO2 that comes along for the ride there, it's kind of a scary trend. And so I think we'd be much better taking those battery resources, which we're learning now, you know, we don't have infinite battery resources. We're starting to see some of the bottlenecks. Instead of making one big truck, make a bunch of hybrids, right? Because those hybrids each need just small batteries. And this would really give us a lot more bang for our buck to quickly reduce CO2. And we talk about this a bit in the book. So we really need to be more honest about the large carbon footprint that comes along with the production, especially of large battery packs, and also from charging these vehicles in many places. But in addition to that, you know, so we need to kind of look at what we really need. How often do I really need this big truck or this big SUV? Can I get away with a smaller vehicle, but maybe share a truck or rent a truck or something when I need it? Again, I don't have all the answers, but we kind of have to look more at what we need versus what we just want if we really want to try to solve this problem. We need to incentivize public transportation more, active travel, you know, and all of the above, basically.
Right. Now, I mean, as you just point out, that in your book, you recommend promoting hybrids as the fastest way to reduce vehicle emissions. And you know, they are pretty amazing, you know, creatures there, because you're actually able not only to in some cases top up with a plug-in hybrid, but you're able to recapture some of the lost energy that would otherwise be going to heat, you know, into recharging the battery. But, you know, and we've had, you know, hybrids for 20 years or so, and they still have only made a certain dent in the market. Is there a way to promote hybrids in a way that doesn't involve, say, government regulations such as tighter fuel economy standards? Or do consumers really need a push to change their buying habits?
Yeah, that's another question I struggle with, because I really think hybrids are a really good option. Again, If you're talking about a full hybrid that you don't, so I think there are advantages to full hybrids and plug-in, but if we just talk about a full hybrid, you don't have to change any, really any of your consumer habits, right? You never have to charge it, and it gets the range and all of that. So I do think the tighter fuel economy standards are important. You know, there are hybrids on the road today that get over 50 miles per gallon. I think those are great options for a lot of people. But really at the end of the day, a lot of it comes down to consumer education. And again, we're being told by the mainstream media and kind of government entities that electric cars are the silver bullet solution to this problem. We, instead of viewing hybrids, which a lot of people view them as a transition technology, or even as an afterthought, we need to be viewing them as part of the solution and educating people that they're part of the solution. They're not just, you know, get a hybrid because hopefully it will then move you into a battery electric vehicle because you start to get more and more used to it. Well, that's fine. And that makes sense for a lot of people, but for other people, no, hybrid is maybe where you need to be for a while. It's not necessarily a transition technology. We also need more hybrid options. So that's part of the problem is, you know, all of the new really cool vehicles that these auto companies are coming out with are fully electric. And so the cool factor for the hybrids, there are some cool plug-in hybrids out there, but especially for full hybrids, you just don't really have that cool factor. Whereas I think every car should have at least a small battery pack in it, you know, for for motive. And we know it allows the engine to run where it's most efficient. So at a minimum, they should at least have a small battery pack. But again, auto companies, they like that zero CO2 credit, and I can't blame them. These were the rules that they were given. And if we switch our regulations now, so we've been allowing them to do that. Now, if tomorrow we say, okay, let's do this on a life cycle basis instead of the tailpipe, and let's make sure we include, you know, charging from the grid and CO2 production from the batteries and things like that, it would become much more clear that hybrids are a great option. And it would allow car companies to reduce their fleet CO2 compared to other technologies. So because we label the battery electric vehicles with this big zero, it makes it really attractive to help them meet their fleet regulations. But in reality, you know, the planet doesn't care where the CO2 came from. So it's not real.
It sounds almost as if, you know, hybrids need their own Tesla. You know, I mean, you talked about how it was, you know, the Tesla came along, and instead of the little nerdy electric vehicle that could barely, you know, go across town, you had like this sleek, sexy, really fast machine. It almost sounds like what you're talking about is to get consumers to buy into hybrids again, they need to have some sort of like sports car hybrid.
Yeah, and there certainly are those out there. There are sports car like plug-in hybrids. But of course, sort of the first hybrid that came along and kind of gained mainstream sort of attention was the Prius. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you remember, but when the Prius came out, you know, all the Hollywood actors and actresses were driving the Prius around because, you know, it showed that they were green and all of that. Same people now are driving around the battery electric vehicles, and that's fine. And the Prius is a great car, but it just didn't have that same sort of sex appeal as the Tesla does. Right. You know, honestly, I asked my son, I said, what is so cool about the Tesla? You know, he doesn't care at all that it's electric. He loves that huge screen that's in there. You know, so there are things we can do to other vehicle types that we can just as easily do to electric. And some of it isn't even necessarily having to do with the fact that it's electric. So I think you're right. I think I'm not sure how to do that. But if something like that came around, I think it would significantly help. I don't know if the ship has already sailed on that, because we've kind of been there, done that with the hybrids. But I certainly hope we can do it. The other thing that's kind of interesting with hybrids, and we talk about in the book as well, is you can get creative with the fact that you're using these multiple powertrains and not, you know, not just focusing on one or the other. You can use geofencing, for example, to, once you drive into an urban area, it can switch on the electric motor, and you can, you know, zero tailpipe emissions within the city center. But then when you need your range and you're driving in the rural areas or city to city, you know, now you can rely also on the internal combustion engine. So it kind of gives you a chance to use the best of both worlds to minimize emissions while maintaining consumer convenience. So that's what I really like about hybrids.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. before we go, I do want to get onto this one point that you've said that switching completely over to full electric vehicles might leave us disappointed if we're trying to reduce transportation sector carbon emissions as quickly as possible. And you've made that case pretty well here today. Are there some new technologies that we should be keeping our eye on that could accomplish, that goal in the coming decade? Something that we haven't touched on yet. And then in the decades to come, some people are talking about switching to hydrogen or ammonia for fuel. Is anything, or natural gas, is anything like that actually possible or feasible?
That's interesting. Definitely possible. But I, it depends on what we're talking about. If we're talking about road transport, passenger vehicles, let's say, which is what we focus mostly on our book. And we do talk about things like hydrogen and ammonia as well. But it's hard for me to imagine that if we're going to go throughout the US and put in an electric vehicle infrastructure, which there's a lot of money being thrown at that right now, then we're going to then go and put in another whole infrastructure for hydrogen. Right. So I think where hydrogen might come into play is for long haul transport, where, you're fueling up at kind of a fixed location and then you're driving a bunch because, the range you can get on either a fuel cell electric vehicle or a hydrogen internal combustion engine is quite high, higher than an electric battery electric vehicle. So I think it could happen there. I think ammonia, because of the toxic nature of ammonia, I'm not sure about how appropriate it is for road transport, although I'm not going to rule it out because I do think we need to continue to look at all these things. But I think for agriculture and sort of off-road stuff, I think ammonia could be a good solution. But again, is there, I don't believe there is one single kind of silver bullet solution. I think we need to kind of keep our eye on all of these things and kind of use them. Instead of going all in, we need to kind of use them smartly. You hear this phrase about electrify everything. All the time. And I say, no, electrify strategically, right? Because in some cases, it just doesn't make a lot of sense. It may in the future, but it certainly doesn't now. And even the engine itself, by the way, the internal combustion engine itself, not only can we use, biofuels, e-fuels, hydrogen even, there's a lot of work looking at hydrogen internal combustion engines, but we can also keep improving the internal combustion engine efficiency. And a lot of people think we've already reached our max there, but we haven't. And there are a lot of technologies out there that are looking to suppress knock in an engine because things you do to try to get more efficiency out of the engine, like increased compression ratio, for example, that's conducive to knock. And so if we can come up with ways through, say, water injection, dedicated EGR, octane on demand, there are all these different technologies out there that are being researched. There are variable compression ratio engines now, cylinder deactivation. There are all these things out there that we need to keep pushing these because they can give us higher efficiency from the engine itself. Now pair that with a hybrid and you're doing really well. So is there a silver bullet? No. Should we be looking at all of these different technologies going forward? Definitely.
Very good. Well, I think that's where we have to leave it for now. I'd like to thank Kelly Senecal for joining us today. His book, Racing Towards Zero, is available through Amazon and via his website, racingtowardszero.com. Dr. Senecal, thank you again for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Those out there in podcast land, be sure to subscribe to ASV TechCast on Anchor, iTunes, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. Thank you for listening. I'm Jeffrey Winters. Until next time, have a great rest of your day.